أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وصلى الله على محمد وعلى آله الطاهرين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the second session of our course from Ali alayhi salam to Al-Mahdi alayhi salam. A course that's going to be discussing the concept of imama from various different dimensions and then zooming into the concept of Imam Mahdi in Islam, and then finishing the course on the practical aspect of it and how to bring all this together in our life during the time of Ghaiba. So in the previous session, we started talking about some of the fundamental discussions that are not necessarily directly related to imama, but they are really important discussions because they set the foundations based on which we're going to discuss imama specifically, right? So we haven't dived into imama yet, okay? We've been talking about the tools that we need to use in order to assess any topic, any religious Islamic topic, and imama being one of them. Then we're going to apply these on the concept of imama in the coming sessions, inshallah. So it's a very crucial part of this journey of analyzing imama and understanding imama in Islam. And alhamdulillah, for this very important topic, we have with us Sheikh Kazim Bojani. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikhana.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
It's really nice to have you again. We had a very interesting discussion in the last session. So let's continue this discussion where we're laying the foundations and we're analyzing the tools that we need to use to understand imama. So in the previous session, we talked about the intellect and the Quran, and we talked about the some of the principles that we need to use that are necessary to use in the process of understanding what the Quran is saying. And so we had finished there, and you had mentioned that there's a few tools, or let's call it methodologies, that we also need to use to discuss, to examine the Quran. So let's go ahead with that.
So before I continue my discussion with where we left last time, I would like to reiterate the importance of this discussion. So as you mentioned, it's like we're getting ready and we're getting all the necessary tools so that when we enter the actual discussion about imama, we have these things in place. So basically, it's like you want to dive deep into the sea, you need to have the right equipment ready. And this is what we're trying to do. Imama is an important topic. There's a lot of depth to it. There's a lot of aspects to it. So, I mean, imagine it's like it is a lot of breadth and aspects that need to be discussed. And each of that has a lot of depth as well. And you rightly said so that here you're looking at a 20 some hour course.
Yeah.
And it might look like, oh, wow, imama is so long. While we are really, if I say that we're scratching the surface and we're getting introduced to the many of the ideas which have much more detail to it, I wouldn't have exaggerated. So these discussions, fundamental in nature, are very, very important to have.
Yeah.
So far we said that understanding any text, and right now we are applying it to the Holy Quran, has a certain methodology, and there are principles to keep in mind. So we spoke about these three very important principles. The first one was that understanding the Holy Quran, it needs to be checked back with those established fundamental realities which have been established through the intellect, through the experimental facts, and even there can be other ways to establish that. The second point was, I'm just briefly summarizing it so these are fresh in our mind. The second point was to have a complete and holistic understanding of the Holy Quran and this text that we're talking about. And the third discussion was to not disregard the context. So, of course, we're not saying that context has a very heavy impact on understanding the verse, but wherever necessary, to whatever extent it's necessary, the context cannot be disregarded. And especially those verses which I said that the context is included in the verse. So the verse itself is saying that, look, this happened, this event happened, al-yawm akmaltu lakum dinakum. So the context is there. So those places have to be carefully understood. So those were some of the principles that we spoke about, that any person who's understanding the Quran must keep in mind. But now there are certain tools certain skills, certain methods that need to be applied. So just to make our discussion concise and not go into too many details, because this is not the place to go into all the details that are there, I'll just very briefly summarize the tools that are required to understand the Holy Quran into these two key important tools. So one of them, the first tool is Arabic as a language. Okay, because the Holy Quran is revealed in this particular language. And this language has so many things in it. So it has words and a whole set of vocabulary. So each word has a certain meaning. And there's so many things that happen with regards to the meaning of individual words. So that's something that anyone who's trying to do tafsir of the Quran or even understand it has to know the meaning of these words. What do they mean? Yep. Then the language is going to have its own structure, its own grammar, its own intricacies, its own way of expressing, for example, different figures of speeches. So a language is a very, it's a complex thing, right? It's a very beautiful phenomenon. It's a thing that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created, this means of communication using languages. So a very good command of Arabic as a language, which includes different aspects, knowing the meaning of the words in Arabic, and even going further, that sometimes these words, when they come in the context of the Quran, they acquire added meaning. There's a specific meaning intended by the Quran. And that happens, right? So I'm writing a book and I want to use a certain word which is commonly used by the people, but I want to add some meaning to it and use it for my own book. That can happen. And that has happened in the Holy Quran, that the words that the Holy Quran uses have to be understood very, very carefully, and there's a lot of precise meaning. And that is tied to an understanding of Arabic, like, what is the root of this word? Where is it coming from? What are the different usages of this word across the Holy Quran? So there's so much detail into it. We won't have time to go into how the structure of Arabic affects our understanding. And there would be many, many examples for that. So, for example, there are prepositions in Arabic. Each preposition can have multiple meanings. So just this word, ba, B, which is a connector, has very many different meanings in Arabic.
And depending on which word it comes with.
Which word it comes with, probably the context. Sometimes we might need to use our intellect, saying that this meaning of this preposition doesn't make sense here, for example.
Yeah, so I was going to say earlier when you said that in the Arabic language we have words and they have different meanings, and the structure of the words can create new meanings. At the end, how do we decipher which one of them was intended by the speaker or the author? It goes back to the principles we had.
Exactly.
When you look at the variety of meaning from one word, whichever one makes sense according to the context within the verse, according to the intellectual context, according to the historical background, if there is one.
Yeah, exactly. And even, for example, certain prepositions are only used with certain verbs and not with the others. In any language, it's like that.
Yeah.
So all that a person wants to understand the Quran should be aware of.
Yeah. So when you're saying that we need to know this Arabic, but as a layman, if I want to not know Arabic in all these details, I just want to follow translations.
So the question there would be that someone would have to understand the language to translate it for you. So basically right now we are talking about the first-hand understanding and a primary understanding of the Quran. You can, and we'll speak about that someone can go and understand the Quran using these tools. So this is someone who doesn't want to rely on another person's academic effort to understand the Quran. He himself wants to go and understand the text without any intermediary, then he'll definitely need to know the Arabic. Now, how much of translations can we use? That is something we'll discuss now. This is something which we should bring up, that if I don't know Arabic, does it mean that now I can't access Quran completely? So that's something that we can come to later. So this was an important point, I think, good you raised it, that right now we are talking about someone a person wants to understand Quran
directly
the way it is in Arabic, of course you need to know the language, the words, the structure, the prepositions, how they're used, and what is the actual intended meaning. I'll just give a very interesting example of how these things are done. So let me give you one very interesting example of how these words are understood and how they're tied to an understanding of Arabic. So let's take this word, which repeats a lot in the Holy Quran, the word kafir.
Disbeliever.
So the regular meaning that comes to our mind is disbeliever, right? You pick up a good number of translations would render the word al-kafir as a disbeliever. But when you go and refer to the Arabic lexicon, and what we mean by the lexicon is the lexicons of that time. So the dictionaries that were compiled in those days.
The ones that represent more accurately what the meaning was at that time.
Recording the meaning that was intended by people when they used to use this word. So, and this is an important thing, right? That I can't pick up a modern Arabic dictionary and find a meaning of a word and they say that, and then say that this is what the Quran meant. No, we need to be careful because we're not absolutely sure that all words have retained their meaning. Probably a good number have, but you can't be sure. So
we need to try and get the earlier sources.
The original and the earlier sources where the Muslims took a lot of effort to record these meanings.
Yeah.
And especially with respect to the Quranic words because it was important for them. So we have specific lexicons just explaining the meanings of the different words used in the Quran. So if you go and refer to those dictionaries, lexicons, the original meaning of kufr is someone who covers something.
Okay,
so covering something is technically the very literal meaning of this word.
Yeah.
But then what does that mean? That a kafir is something who covers something. Okay, so now this needs to be worked out. And now when you start working this out, there's so many technicalities involved. I'll just give you one example. It's interesting. So beginning of Surah Al-Baqarah. So the initial few verses, you reach a point where it says, "Inna alladhina kafaru sawa'un alayhim aandartahum am lam tundirhum la yu'minun." Okay. So saying, those who disbelieve, so it's now, Quran is now describing who is a kafir. Okay, and this helps us to understand the meaning, right? So it says that you admonish them or you don't admonish them, it doesn't make any difference to them. They are like, don't... guidance won't have any effect on them. Now, this is beginning of the Quran, right? And this is your first encounter with the meaning of the word kafir and kufr. You read this, you'll say that, okay, it's very clear, right? So, kufr means those people who have reached such a stage whereby guidance doesn't have any effect on them. And in fact, this is the meaning that Allama Tabatabai mentions in Tafsir al-Mizan. Let me read this very small passage. So, he mentions this verse and says, "Ha'ula'i qawmun thabatu ala al-kufr wa tamakkana al-juhudu min kulubihim." So he's saying that these people, which this verse is referring to, these people are those whom the kufr has sunk into their hearts. It's become part of them. And juhud, which means that denial and rebellion against Allah has become part of their qalb. So now, if I'm not careful, and I just say that, okay, this is clear, that kafir means someone who there's now no hope for him, and because of his own actions, he's reached a stage, now the guidance has no effect on him. Sawa'un alay. So if you go by this understanding of kafir, we'd be making a mistake. This is not what a kafir is in the terminology of the Quran.
So you just said Allama Tabatabai said that.
Okay, so the interesting thing is he says this. He says that I just read, "Ha'ula'i qawmun thabatu ala al-kufr wa tamakkana al-juhudu min kulubihim." Then he explains that why am I saying this? Wa yadullu alayhi, what? This thing which Allah said, sawa'un alayhim. You guide them, you admonish them or not, it's the same for them. Then he stops a bit and then he says that la yumkin istitraduhu fi haqqi jami'il kuffar. So he's saying that this state whereby guidance has no impact on this person, you can't say that all the kuffar are like that.
Okay.
So what he's trying to say here is that this verse is referring to a specific group of kuffar who have gone to an extreme limit in their kufr.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then you may ask that, why do you say that? Quran is saying, "Alladina kafaru sawa'un alayhim." That means all the kuffar are like that. He mentions the reason. He says that, وَإِلَّا إِن سَدَّ بَابُ الْهِدَايَةِ. If you say that all kuffar are like that, all those whom the Quran refers to them as al-kafir are such that guidance has no impact on them, then this would mean that the door of guidance is closed for them. وَالْقُرْآنُ يُنَادِي عَلَى خِلَافِهِ. If you look at the other verses of the Quran, so you see those same principles are coming. He's looking at other verses of the Quran, whereby clearly the Holy Prophet is going and guiding the kuffar.
In fact, the whole Islam came to guide the kuffar.
And
right?
We have many, many examples where these same kuffar, at least some of them, would become Muslims. So see, this...
So clearly the word kafir here, the meaning of it is not necessarily this very extreme meaning.
So how do we ascertain these degrees of meaning? Hope it's an academic effort. Allama Tabatabai, look, he comes and says something. Then he says that, look, I'm saying that this verse means this. But this is not the meaning that can be applied to all the kuffar. And see, this precise understanding is so important to solve so many of the questions. That we have questions that, those people who are not Muslims, we call them kafir, right? They're not on the right path, they're not on the right religion. Do we say that they can never be guided? Do we say that all of them are going to the hellfire? Do we say that... they're all bad and evil people? No, we're not saying that. Yes, there is a section amongst them, those oppressors, those perpetual evil doers. Yeah, they are those.
And those who are kafir out of knowing the truth and denying it.
That juhud, which the Quran talks about. Yeah. So when it talks about the Fir'aun, he says that wajahadu biha wastaykanatha anfusahum. That they denied the truth, they rebelled against the truth, whilst they knew that this is the truth. Yeah, that's a dangerous path to take. But do all the people whom we term as kafir are such that? Definitely not. No. The door of guidance is open. In fact, this is our duty as Muslims to go and guide them, not shun them away. Yes, those oppressors, those very specific people, we keep a distance from them. But the people who regularly we would term them as kafir doesn't have such a heavy negative connotation attached to it that you're supposed to shun them away. No, you bring them closer to you. That's what Rasulullah used to do.
So we can say here that in terms of the word kafir, there's a lot of different perspectives and meanings to this word. So one is a kafir in its general sense, somebody who doesn't believe.
Yeah.
But then a kafir can also be a terminology, it can also be referring to those who, going back to its linguistic sense, those who cover the truth intentionally, and those are the ones who cannot be guided. And then you have the kafir in the fiqh sense of it.
Exactly.
And then you have when we say that all the kafirs will go to hell, it's not considering the kafirs who are ignorant. So the mustad'afin, for example. Yeah. Then you have let me just add one more. When you're saying that, and fight the kuffar, fighting the kuffar doesn't mean all those who are not believers. It's talking about a specific group
of people. So this shows that one word in the Quran, it's so heavily linked to the literal meaning, which means covering, but it acquires so many different forms and it reflects itself in so many different ways.
Mm.
So you need to have an expert in Arabic, expert who can link this meaning to the original meaning and give you a sensible and an accurate understanding of this Quranic concept. So, this is what we need to do.
It's an expert who not only knows, can refer back the meaning back to its linguistic original meaning, but also know the terminologies that are used. Because sometimes some of these words become terminologies to mean something completely different to its original meaning.
And
sometimes the Quran may change a word from its original meaning to a new terminology.
Exactly. And the clear example of that would be the word Salah.
Salah, for example.
Salat originally means to do dua, to pray. And now the Holy Quran has taken it and it's linked to the original meaning.
Yeah.
Our Salat, the prayers, is a type of dua. But it's given it a very specific format.
Form,
And maybe you can even say that Quran does that to a lot of the words. It takes the words from Arabic. It keeps that connection with the original meaning, but it enriches and it adds a lot of meaning to that word. So basically, this is a tool that someone needs to have, a good linguistic command whereby you can put together different things said about this word. One place it says Alladina kafuru are like that. Another place is Alladina kafuru are like that. So you combine all these meanings and you come to a accurate understanding of this word. This requires someone to have a good command on the language and how these usages of the words work across the Holy Quran. Yeah.
In fact, there's a verse in the Holy Quran that uses the word kafir for completely irrelevant to the concept of disbelief, right? It's referring to people who work in agriculture. And they,
so basically, they're covering the seeds.
They're covering the seeds, and they're referred to as kafir, and they've not done anything
so
wrong.
They're not kafir. They're good people. They're good just the literal meaning used.
Yeah.
There's another context in which this word is used is where it's the opposite of shukr.
Yeah.
So that's another meaning of a kafir, and those people who would have a blessing, but not use it properly. So that's the reality of shukr, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the reality of shukr is that you get a blessing, you appreciate its existence, see the connection with Allah, and use it in the right manner. So if that doesn't happen, that also is called kufran. So it's again the same word. So this linguistic discussion, being able to make sense out of these precise concepts. I just showed you an example how Allama Tabataba is trying to do. He starts with something, then he says it's about a specific group. It's a certain level of kufr. Not all kuffar are like that. This, for example, is a place where you can see this in action. An expert in tafsir doing it for us.
Yeah.
Of course, this is a very brief glimpse I have given here. I mean, those people who are interested, they can refer. He continues the discussion. And the idea is to reach the reality of kufr from the Quranic perspective. So this is an important tool that we need. And I just gave you example of words and their meanings. There's so much about the grammar, the sentence structure. So all these Arabic syntax, Arabic morphology, sarf and nahw. Then you have the balagat of the Quran, the eloquence. All these are different fields that are studied in the house,
and they really have an impact in the meaning, right? It's not just a science for the sake of learning something and being an academic in it.
So
it has a big impact in the
all
meaning.
Of these have an impact in understanding the accurate intended meaning.
Yeah.
So the pursuit we started in the beginning.
Yeah. And we're still again talking about the apparent meaning.
The batin is
something else.
And there's a whole discussion about what does this batin mean. And who has the access to this batin and how much of it is accessible to a ma'asum and not ma'asum, that's a separate discussion. But even the zahir of the Quran, it's an ocean of knowledge.
Okay.
But you need the right person to go and able to pick out those pearls from
So a question, what were the Bedouins in the time of the Prophet doing? If we need to study so much, how are the Bedouins going about understanding a Quran in which is supposed to be addressed to them? How were they understanding it?
So can you elaborate the question a bit more? So, I mean, what I understand is the Bedouins, they knew Arabic. They knew the sentence structure. They knew the meanings of these words. So when these verses would be recited for them, the regular meaning would come to their mind.
Mm-hmm.
So they did not have an issue in understanding what these verses are trying to say. And especially if there would be an added meaning, an added depth to these concepts, the Holy Prophet would come and explain it. Not only the Holy Prophet, these verses themselves would very clearly mention that added meaning. So the same example that Alladina kafaru, who are these? The verse is explaining. So as far as the apparent meaning of the verse is concerned, because they understood Arabic well, they could understand the apparent meaning. Yeah, I'm not trying
so
to say
so this challenge is for us today who don't know Arabic and who don't know the
challenge.
Arabic at that time. Yeah.
Yeah, of
course. It's not like this is something that that the people at that time couldn't do, and it's sort of going against the whole. Because one of the things about the Quran and its a miracle aspect is that the people to whom it was revealed to were able to relate to it and understand it. And here you are sitting here telling us, no, you can't understand it, you need expertise in it. But no, they had that expertise, it was in them, they were masters of language.
Therefore, the Quran says, as Arabiyyin Mubin, we have revealed it in clear Arabic, in the sense that those people, because they were the original speakers of that language and very good at the Arabic. We know that that was the peak of the Arabic language, poetry and everything. So their understanding of the apparent meaning was good and accurate. Yes, I'm not claiming that they would understand relationships everything. Between all yeah. these different
that's, meanings. That's not linguistics
that's
anymore.
That's not linguistics. Technically, that's an intellectual pursuit. So yeah. we're not saying that those Bedouins who, for example, who's not thinking and who's not able to draw implications. So this is what intellect does, right? So you get the literal meaning. From this meaning, now you can draw implications. You say, oh, this implies this. This implies this. And if someone has a very strong intellect, from one verse, he can take out maybe 10 meanings
yeah.
accurately
yeah.
using the right method, which we're saying that intellect. So we're not claiming that they understood all the aspects and all the implications, but we can safely say that they understood the
linguistic aspect of it. They had that covered. Yeah, had that. Though now I think about it, when we're discussing this question with one of the brothers some time back, I remember him sending me a few hadith from early sources about companions of the Prophet asking the Prophet about to explain certain verses that we didn't understand. This verse, what's this word meaning there? For example,
so we can try and put these different things we said together and say that they were Arabs, and when these verses were revealed to them, they understood the basic and the apparent meaning of the Quran. Probably what they're looking for and they're seeking from the Holy Prophet is explanation, the depth, how it relates to other concepts. Or for example, this verse says this thing about kuffar, but there's another verse that has said a different thing. How do you combine these two meanings to come to a better understanding such that these don't contradict or negate each other? So a lot of the things that the Holy Prophet would say would be explanation of these verses, making connections, or even at times maybe even adding detail, because we'll come to this discussion that the Holy Prophet of Islam was not just the explainer of the Quran, but he himself is an independent source of Islam. This is an important thing. So let's say there's a place where he's not explaining the Quran, but he's saying that I, as the Prophet of Allah, I am saying this, that also is a source of knowledge. So we'll come to this idea that the sunnah and the words of the will define it. When we say the sunnah of the Holy Prophet, what do we mean? Just his words, or no, it's beyond that? So basically, we also have, it's good that this thing came up, that in addition to the Holy Quran, we also have another transmitted source, and that's the hadith, and it's very, very important, but that's what
another session, inshallah. Yeah.
So I think I think we'll not go in more detail regarding this first tool, which is having a good amount of expertise in Arabic. I'll just quickly move. Do we have time, or should we take a break right now and then we come back?
Let's continue another few minutes, and then we'll take a break.
Yeah. So what I'll do, I'll just mention the second tool. The second tool might be slightly technical in nature. I'm trying to avoid technical terminology and trying to give examples and explain this. And that second tool, which is very, very important to understand the Holy Quran, is a science, is a field of study studied in the Hausa by the name of Usulul Fiqh. Okay. Usually they translate it as principles of jurisprudence. Okay. You may wonder, what has Fiqh to do with Quran and tafsir? So
and imama.
Yeah, I know. I'll have to make several connections and build this gap to make it very relevant for our discussion. So Usulul Fiqh is a study which started with this idea that we have this science called fiqh. So the idea was that in the Sharia, in Islam, we have different obligations and prohibitions. So we have things that are wajib, there are things that are haram. So the scholars wanted to understand these things precisely. So they would refer to these sources of Islam, so Quran and the Hadith, and they would work out these details of Islamic Sharia. For example, are prayers obligatory or not? Is Hajj wajib or not? On whom the Hajj is wajib? What are the conditions of Hajj? So the regular ahkam that we studied, it's discussed in a science called fiqh. Now, a lot of the work that these fuqaha would have to do was based on understanding text accurately.
Mm-hmm.
When they started working on these texts, the verses of the Quran that talk about ahkam.
So you're talking about a process in time, right? In history.
In time. Yeah. So I'm explaining how it developed.
And yeah.
So they would go to the Quran and they said, you have this ayatul ahkam. So maybe 500 to 600 verses of the Quran that talk about these practical ahkam that we all have to follow. They would go look at this, they look at the ahadith, and using this, they would try to arrive at a conclusion and give fatwa based on that. So they would say, they would write that this is how you should act, this is how you should pray. So this was the...
Basically, coming to a scholarly opinion on what the Quran is saying about it.
So basically, it was a similar pursuit whereby they wanted to understand some verses of the Quran and also a lot of hadith, because majority of our ahkam are from the ahadith, right? And it's an important thing to note. Whilst they're doing it, they started realizing that only knowledge of Arabic grammar is not sufficient to accurately understand the meaning of these ayatul ahkam and the ahadith related to fiqh. So what they started doing, they started developing a whole new set of tools and principles that will help them to understand the text even more accurately, one step further than just the meaning that we get using the Arabic grammar. I know, if I don't give an example, it's not going to become clear. So let me start with an example, and this is going to help us. So, the Holy Quran is full of commands. Okay, it's full of places where the God is commanding.
Yeah, do's and don'ts.
Do's and don'ts. And usually, they come in the form of commands, right? So, it comes and tells you. So, I'll give you. For example, it says, Aqimus Salat, establish prayer. وَآتُ الزَّكَاتِ, give charity. It's a command, right? Okay. Let me give you another example. وَجَاهِدُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ, do jihad in the way of Allah. Okay. So the question is, okay, let me ask you here, that if I just know Arabic grammar and the meaning of these words, and if I ask you, let's say you know the meaning of these words, and I ask you, what do you understand from this? When Allah says, أَقِيمُ الصَّلَاةِ, what does it mean?
Establish prayer. It's telling me to establish prayer.
Question, does it make it wajib? Is it part of Sharia or no? And when I say wajib, it means that if I leave this out, I'm entitled to divine punishment. He can forgive me, but it gives a certain right to Allah to say that, look, this was your duty, you should have done that. And you did not do your duty, now I can punish you. Of course, if there's no repentance and all that.
So I think a general person would say, seeing that Allah is the one saying it, from His authority and the fact that He owns us, technically, when He's saying that, I understand that I have to do it.
So if you just use our common understanding of language, and in any language you say that, if there's a command, especially from God, definitely that should mean that it's an obligatory thing, right?
Yeah.
And there's a prohibition that would mean that it's a haram thing. Okay, so far so good. But now, let me give you a few examples where this doesn't work out.
Okay.
Okay, so now it's going to become confusing. So, the second example, Jahidu fi sabilillah. Okay. Question, is it obligatory on every single person or not?
To do jihad in the way of Allah.
Yeah. It's a question, right? So, Aqimu Salat, maybe it's easy to understand. Say that God is saying, Aqimu, or people,
I'll be smart and say that here jihad means that struggle with the self.
Okay, so, this again is a question that we need to answer. And this goes back to the first point, that what does jahidu mean? What's the apparent meaning according to the Arabic language? So that's, we need to answer that. But let's say I say that jahidu here means all types of jihad. We don't restrict it to the internal jihad and external jihad. And probably with the context, at least in some of the verses, you can clearly say that it's talking about that physical external jihad. Yeah. Question, it's saying jahidu, it's addressing everyone, everyone should go. But when you look at how the fuqaha have understood this, many of them said that it's not wajib aini, it's kifai.
Hmm.
Okay, question, why? What's the reason?
On what basis are they saying that?
Are you like going away from the literal meaning? The literal meaning saying, jahidu. I'm saying, all of you go. Okay, why do you say? So, this question. Let me make things even worse for you. Okay, so there's a third, another verse in the Quran that says, إِذَا قُمْتُمْ إِلَى الصَّلَاةِ فَاغْسِلُوا وُجُوهَكُمْ وَأَيْدِيكُمْ. The verse of wudu, right? Okay. So, the meaning is that when you want to recite prayers, go and do wudu. It's a command. Fagsilu wujuhakum aydiyakum. It's a way of saying that go and do wudu. Okay. Question. If someone does not do wudu and does not pray, is he entitled to double punishment? Because he's forsaken two commands. One command is fagsilu wujuhakum, the command to do wudu. And the other command, akimus salah. So there are two commands. One place Allah is saying akimus salat, and then another place Allah is saying fagsilu wujuhakum. And let us say someone,
so if somebody doesn't do wudu, is entitled to be punished,
to
basically
a separate punishment. None of the fuqaha have said that. No one says that if I don't do wudu, if a person doesn't do wudu and he does not pray because of that, or his prayer becomes batil, he's just committed one sin.
Of not praying.
Okay. But the question comes, it's a command, fagsilu wujuhakum. Okay, now, when they started seeing that one command, so command is same. Akimu is a command.
So the idea Jahid of commanding is there throughout these examples.
But it's rendered in different meanings. Sometimes this command becomes a wujub, aini. It's a wajib on everyone. Sometimes this same command turns into wajib kifai. Sometimes this same command turns into something that's not even independently wajib.
And in fact
right, there's no punishment for it.
And right now I'm thinking of another command. Allah says, Kulu washrabu.
Okay, yeah. So exactly, I was coming to an example whereby there's no obligation. So excellent, you brought this example. This is much more clear. I had another example.
Allah
so
is commanding me to drink, so I'm going to...
So basically saying, Kulu washrabu wa la tusrifu. Kulu is a command. Does it mean it's obligatory for me to, for example, eat something during the day? Because it's kulu, right? How do I obey it? No one has understood this command like this. The question, where do you answer these kind of questions, that commands in general, what do they mean? How do we understand?
So it needs to be studied, basically. Because we're seeing commands in all these examples, but they happen to have different meanings.
Yeah.
So we need to sort of sit down and try to get our heads around, why do they have different meanings? What makes them give different meanings?
Is it very random, or there's a certain procedure? There are ways to say, for example, look, jahidu fi sabilillah is wajib kifai.
Yeah. And
kulu washrabu is not even any obligation. Yeah. It's telling me something else.
Yeah.
You can at the most say that it's encouraging me to stay healthy and benefit from Allah's blessings. And it's trying to tell me, don't do Isra.
I guess the main thing about creating a whole discussion and a science behind this is to formalize it and make it unbiased, that I shouldn't bring my own biases to the Quran and feel, okay, you know what, jihad fi sabilillah, I don't want to go to there, so we'll make it kifai, you know?
Yeah, so that was the exact point, that they wanted the fuqaha. So it started with fiqh and the fuqaha trying to understand these ahkam in a very accurate manner. But they developed something called usulul fiqh, principles of jurisprudence. So they wanted to do jurisprudence fiqh, tell us what our practical duties are. They saw that these kind of questions, we need to deal them somewhere. Okay, because they're coming everywhere. Every other verse, every other hadith is a command. So I need to come out of this setting of fiqh. Okay, go in another room and just talk about this idea that commands in a language, what are the different meanings that they can give?
Mm-hmm.
And therefore you have this whole big section in usulul fiqh discussing awamir. Okay, so those who have studied usul al-fiqh, they have an idea of that. So there's a big, huge chunk of discussion that's going to answer all these questions. When, so starting from here, that when does a command refer to wujub and when it does not?
If it refers to wujub, when is it kifaya, when is it aini?
When is it, so for example, sometimes there are commands that I have to do instantly, immediately. Yeah.
And when can I
when,
wait?
When can I wait?
And in all these cases, if I'm not sure, then what's the default position? So exactly. all these
questions, initially they're developed in usul al-fiqh, but it became a very important and key tool to understanding any text for that matter. So it's just looking at a text and trying to understand those a bit more complex meanings beyond just the grammar. So this, and it's a very unique field of study that the Muslims developed. And especially the madhab of Ahlul Bayt, the usul al-fiqh we have, the amount of energy and academic effort that has been put, and the precision that it delivers, usul al-fiqh, in understanding the Holy Quran. So it's an important tool and component when it comes to doing tafsir of the Quran. Okay. So you cannot have a mufassir who hasn't formally studied usul al-fiqh and can't make sense out of these things. And believe me, you can make big blunders if these principles of usul al-fiqh are not understood and they're not applied. The meaning can completely go in a manner that, you use the right word, disaster. That's what we are headed towards.
Yeah.
And I would end this by saying that, look, we've been speaking about the principles that we need, the tools that we need. You need to know Arabic. You need to know morphology. You need to know all these things. You need to know principles of jurisprudence. If you combine all of this together, I can summarize it by saying that you need expertise.
You need training at least. You need to learn the knowledge and you need to practice it and get strong at it.
So okay. That so very Sheikh precise Ra- understanding let's, has let's, to come from the experts. It's very yeah. important point to note.
Yeah.
And I would say this here that we have faced a lot of damage and problems because of people lacking expertise, thinking that they're experts, coming...
Or thinking there's no need for expertise.
There's no need for expertise. Some cases thinking that they are experts whilst they did not have formal training. Their credentials wouldn't be approved by the top experts. It's important, right? Like, I cannot go to a doctor about whose credentials I'm not sure. At least, if he's claiming to be a doctor, I should get like 2-3 doctors to... I should speak to them that, is he okay? Or he just faked a degree? Tell me, it's my life and death. So this is a key matter that we need to be aware
of.
It's important.
So there's a few questions on this, definitely. I'm not going to let you go saying that we need to follow the experts and then not question you on that. But we'll take a quick break. And we also want to quickly link this to our discussion of imamah. So we digressed into usul al-fiqh and into fiqh. But how is this linking to understanding aqaidi matters, especially the matter of imamah in the Quran? So we'll discuss this. Let's just take a quick...
I have interesting examples for that. So I'll bring it up
when
we continue after this.
Sure. So let's take a short break, inshallah. And we'll be back in a few moments. So we'll see you in a bit.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم هل أتى على الإنسان حين من الدهر لم يكن شيئا مذكورا إنا خلقنا الإنسان من نطفة أمشاج نبتليه فجعلناه سميعا بصيرا إنا هديناه السبيل إما شاكرا وإما كفورا إنا أعتدنا للكافرين سلاسل وأغلالا وسعيرا إن الأبرار يشربون من كأس كان مزاجها كافورا عينا يشرب بها عباد الله يفجرونها تفجيرا يوفون بالنذر ويخافون يوما كان شره مستطيرا ويطعمون الطعام على حبه مسكينا ويتيما وأسيرا إنما نطعمكم لوجه الله لا نريد منكم جزاء ولا شكورا إنا نخاف من ربنا يوما عبوسا قمطريرا فوقاهم الله شر ذلك اليوم ولقاهم نضرة وسرورا وجزاهم بما صبروا جنة وحريرا متكئين فيها على الأرائك لا يرون فيها شمسا ولا زمهريرا ودانية عليهم ظلالها وذللت قطوفها تذليلا ويطاف عليهم بآنية من فضة وأكواب كانت قواريرا قوارير من فضة قدروها تقديرا ويسقون فيها كأسا كان مزاجها زنجبيلا عينا فيها تسمى سلسبيلا
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters. Welcome back to the second session of the course. So we were discussing with Sheikh Kazim of different things regarding how we should approach the Quran and we were talking about the second tool that we need to use to approach the Quran, to understand the Quran accurately, which is the usulul fiqh. For now, what we're going to discuss with Sheikh is this usul only limited to fiqh, and which is what Sheikh mentioned earlier is a study that grew across the years when the fuqaha would discuss certain principles that allow them to derive laws from the Quran as accurately as possible. And this science obviously developed to become more and more accurate until what we have today, where it's really expanded itself. So Sheikh, so we went into usul al-fiqh, but the brothers and sisters have come here for imamah.
That was the point that I was coming to. So as I mentioned, I was just giving you a historical background of how things started. But it happens many times, right, that because of a certain need, a certain science or something is developed. And when it starts developing, they start realizing that, oh, it's something I can use it in other places as well. It happens in science, right? So a person who, for example, discovered formula of a chemical compound, for example, he was just working on a certain chemical reaction. And he said that, oh, wow, I found this amazing chemical reaction. Only to realize that, oh, the same thing can be used in so many other places. Yeah. It's a discovery that allowed them to use it in so many different settings. So the same thing happened with usulul fiqh. It started with the idea of understanding these verses so that the practical ahkam could be understood accurately. But once this tool was developed, it was realized that it's actually those general principles for understanding any text. So these same principles which are discussed in usulul fiqh, for example, the example I was giving, that look, when there is a command, it can have so many different meanings. This same idea can also be applied in matters related to aqidah, for example, which are mentioned in the Quran. So you can use the same tools and principles to accurately understand that when Quran is asking us for a certain thing related to al-Aqidah, how do we understand it? So these same tools would come. Of course, Usulul Fiqh is a diverse area of study. So I gave example of kamats. We can talk about so many different things which are used in texts everywhere. Yeah,
those general principles.
Those general principles, those general combinations that we see in any text. So I'll give one example to just make it clear. And even it a bit relates to the discussion on Imam. So, for example, you have this verse in the Holy Quran which it says, "Ati'u Allah wa ati'u Rasul wa ulil amri minkum." Okay. And we said in the beginning that, right, we don't want to impose any meaning on the Quran. I don't want to preconceive a meaning and say that, no, I know what this verse means. And I'm just going to say that this verse means what I already know. No. So, let's kind of keep aside all the meanings that we have about this verse in our mind, keep that aside and just look at step by step the procedural way. The first step we do is look at the meaning of the words, and the meanings are clear. Ati'u Allah, obey Allah. Ati'u Rasul, obey the Prophet. And we know that Ar-Rasul here means the Holy Prophet. Wa ulil amri minkum. And now, if you look at the literal meaning of the word ulil amr, it translates as the holders of authority. And it means the political authority, those who have the political system in their control. The political leaders, if you want to say. Minkum, amongst the Muslims. So if you just look at this verse, and if you don't have Usulul Fiqh to help you, what might happen, and this conclusion was drawn in history and even today, whereby it is said that, look, anyone who is Ulil Amr, who becomes an instance of Ulil Amr, Quran is saying you have to obey. So for example, I'll give very
blunt example.
Yeah, blunt and negative. So for example, Saddam Hussein was Ulil Amr in Iraq for a good period. He had the government in his control. Okay. And there were people who came and said that Quran is telling you, you have to obey him. Now this doesn't sound right, right? Okay, now the question is that it doesn't sound right to us because we dislike the guy. If someone comes and tells you that Allah wants you to obey, okay, should I justify it? People have justified it, and it's not even. He said that, look, if you don't obey Ulil Am, is going to cause everything is going to go haywire. Bad government is better than not having a government where there's civil war. You tell me.
And also, ATO, as you said earlier, is a command.
It's
right?
A command. So ATO it's obligatory.
Means you have to do it. It's obligatory for us to obey.
And I can very well justify it. You tell me civil war where everyone is killing each other is better, or at least some Ulil Amr is better. But it doesn't sound right, right? Like there's some issue with this. What's the issue? We missed on these tools that are developed in Usulul Fiqh. So what would they say is that, okay, fine, this verse is saying Ati'u Allah wa Ati'u Rasul wa Ulil Amr. Okay. But you look at the other verses of the Quran, or even in the narrations, or even use your own intellect. When I do that, I come to this conclusion that Allah cannot make obedience of an oppressor obligatory on me. My intellect can conclusively tell me that this is not possible. Look at the other verses of the Quran where it's emphasizing on justice, and in fact
fighting
it's saying
oppression.
It's saying that it sent the prophets. Why? لِيَكُومَ النَّاسُ بِالْكِسْتِ. Okay, Allah sent the prophets who are the leaders whose obedience is obligatory. We have so many verses of the Quran tells that you have to obey the prophets unconditionally. Why? لِيَكُومَ النَّاسُ بِالْكِسْ. So we can establish justice. So all these verses. So now, Usulul Fiqh comes and tells us that if you have a general statement which says that, for example, Ulil Amr, you have to obey them, all of them, because Ulil Amr doesn't have a condition to it. But in other words, there is a condition that comes and limits the scope of this Ulil Amr to Ulil Amr that are just. So this idea is called taqeed or takhsis in the terminology of Usulul Fiqh, where you have something which is mutlak or am. It has a very broad scope. It includes everything. In another place, the speaker says thing that comes and limits the scope of the first sentence. Right. Yeah. And if you want to see a clear example of this, you can see in the written laws that you have in different countries, in different topics. So initially they would say a very general thing.
And then they'll go and have...
And then they'll have conditions to this. Yeah. Okay, we said that thing that was very general, but now we're going to put conditions to it. We're going to limit the scope. We're going to make it, they say, mukayyad. We're going to put a qaid to it.
So this is where one of the things that Usulul Fiqh would teach us is that when you come to a general statement, don't straight away assume that it means the general aspect of it is intended. It could have a place that's that reducing the scope
of it.
And I guess Usul al-Fiqh will also teach us when are the occasions when we can take the general aspect of the verse.
Exactly. So for example, one of the things that they say is that if you have a general statement in the Quran, you can't take it with its all the generality. You have to search for a conditioner of that. So you have to go in all the verses of the Quran, and I would add to that, you have to go in all the authentic ahadith. We'll speak about that, what's authentic and what's not authentic. And then after, let's say, you went through all of the Quran and all of the hadith and you didn't find something that would limit the scope of that thing, then you are okay.
Yeah. Now you know that the intended meaning was the general meaning. Yeah,
and
there's nothing.
And
this goes back to what we said earlier, I think at the start of the session, where we want to understand the holistic mindset of this.
This is a technical way of getting that full understanding. And this technical way is taught to us by this science and discipline called the Usul al-Fiqh. So there's so many examples. So
let me just clarify this. Usul al-Fiqh, the terminology is a bit misleading because it's Usul al-Fiqh, but we also use it in Aqidah, we use it in Akhlaq, these are the principles of understanding Quran and Hadith in different ways. Now, obviously, the very detailed, minute details would differ in the different fields, but the general understanding is the same.
A very clear example is that Quran comes and says, Ahallallahu al-bay. We have made halal bay, trade, buying and selling. Okay, it's general, right? It should mean any type of buying and selling. Any commodity I can sell, right? If you take the general, Quran is saying buying and selling is halal. Okay, immediately says وَحَرَّمَ الرِّبَى. So it's saying that, okay, I just said that bay is halal, but there is a type of bay, there's a type of buying and selling. If that buying and selling leads to riba, of course there's a certain meaning of what riba means in buying and selling. If a buying and selling transaction leads to riba, that's not permitted. You wouldn't insist that no, Allah has said that ahallallahu al-bay, and this is mutlaq, this is general, it includes all types of bay. No, you'd say that no, the verse is saying that no, limit.
So in this case, the condition is attached to the general
statement. Yeah, so all these
in other cases, it's detached. So muttasil and munfasil.
This idea of having, we don't use the technical terms a lot, but you have this mukhassis, which is limiting the scope, which is muttasil, is attached. But at times you'll have ahallallahu al-bay, you'll have an authentic narration telling that bay'ul khamri haramun, for example. Mm-hmm. Buying and selling alcohol is haram. What it does, you combine these two, you have a general thing which says all types of buying and selling are halal. You cut this one portion, say that no, buying and selling in alcohol is haram. And this
shows, we'll discuss it in more detail, but this really shows how the Quran and the teachings of the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt as an extension go hand in hand. They are part of that whole...
And we'll later, if we get chance, we'll in our next session, we'll come to this idea, because it's out there. People are discussing that, you know, this idea that if there is anything in the hadith that goes against the Quran, then we don't accept that hadith. Now this needs to be carefully defined.
What does it mean by against? What does against? It mean?
So this is a good example. So for example, the Quran says ahallallahu al-bay, that buying and selling is halal. Hadith is saying buying and selling alcohol is haram. It's against the Quran, right? Okay, discard that. Now from tomorrow, go and start. Everyone would be happy. Like they'd say that, oh, okay, man, we can buy and sell alcohol. we know this is not a right conclusion. So there's a specific meaning intended when it is said that if there's something against the Quran in hadith, that we have to discard that hadith. There's a specific meaning, but we'll come to that. It's an important
discussion that we'll have later, inshallah.
Yeah. So I think I think we stop our discussion on this usulul fiqh and some of these very important principles, and you mentioned it rightly. Some of the scholars have said that it's not actually usulul fiqh, this part. It's actually usulul fahm. These are the principles of understanding text, but those very general ones. And it's a unique science, and it's very interesting. It gives you a lot of insight into understanding text accurately, and you can even use it in your day-to-day life. It's quite useful too.
So let me quickly just give another example related to our aqidah. So we have, and this is where all these components that we've been talking about come together, basically. And usul fiqh is that thing that brings all these things together. So, for example, we have a verse of the Quran that says, if you believe in Allah and the Day of Judgment, and you do good deeds, then you get paradise. Does this mean that getting paradise, all you need is these two components of belief, just Allah and the Day of Judgment? Is it exclusive? Okay. If we don't have a correct understanding, then when we happen to hit this verse of the Quran, because we're not used to reading the Quran from start to end, right? We just open the Quran said, once in a while.
The right
and you found the right verse. Like, okay, just belief in the Quran and Allah and the Day of Judgment. But we find in other places of the Quran where it says, no, actually the belief necessary for salvation, actually belief in Allah and the Day of Judgment, but it adds three more, the Prophet, the books and the angels.
Yeah.
Wow.
And who knows, there can be other things that are added by other verses and probably even by hadith.
Exactly. So what tells us that this verse that has these five is also exclusive to this? When this guy happened to hit these five, the other one happened to hit those two. Maybe there is another place in the Quran that adds one or two or three or four or more elements of belief that are also important for salvation.
Exactly.
Just that it hasn't brought it in that verse. And Usulul Fahm helps us to put these together and know when to take a generalization, when to make something exclusive, when to not making exclusive, and so on.
And this, you're very right, that so heavily affects our understanding of the verses of the Quran. And there's a big, knowing Arabic is not sufficient. Mistakes can happen if these intricacies are not taken into consideration. Yeah. This is a very good example that, so the only way I would be able to safely say that this is that exclusive list of things needed for salvation is when I've gone through all of the Quran and all of the hadith, because hadith is also a source of religion, and I have enumerated all those pieces which in different places have been mentioned to be necessary for salvation. Yes, then you can say that, okay, these 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, I've gone through all of it. And now these are the ones necessary for salvation. I can't just go and say, this was just mentioned, belief in Allah and the hereafter, and therefore I don't need anything else. There's no that exclusivity in that specific one. Yeah. So, and usulul fiqh would discuss all these things in detail.
Okay, so now let's move on. And you mentioned something that I think would be a bit disturbing for many people. And it's been in my mind, I want to keep bringing it up, but now is the right time. Is you keep saying that we need experts. So are you now, so I want to challenge you on this. Are you suggesting that understanding religion, and actually religion is only for the experts, only for the ulama, and it's not accessible to the lay people?
So this is one of those difficult and tricky questions. And the way to answer that is saying that it's yes and no. it sounds fancy also, right? So the question is a very important one, that on one side, I think it should be clear for my audience that we've spoken so much about the tools needed, the principles that need to be applied. And this is just in theory, right? Needs practice. Mm. Someone has to, this is important, right?
Application is important.
Application, someone who gets used to understanding the Quran, tries it a few times, has teachers to train him. It's a process, right? It's not a thing that you get so easily. With all that being said, I'm sure everyone would agree that definitely you need expertise to understand the Holy Quran. So
the least you need is time. Yeah, you need a lot of time in your hand.
Yeah, you need a lot of time in your hand. And even in the external world, we see this, right? Like, who has managed to write a good accurate tafsir. Someone who's given his, I mean, say, life to Quran, right? It's not an easy thing. Someone who's read Quran so many times, he's thought about it, he knows Arabic grammar, he refers to the lexicons, he knows usulul fiqh, he's trying to put this. Look at how Allama Tabatabai is careful. He starts with the verse, he mentions the meaning, then says that, look, but there are other verses that are saying that all kuffar are not they're close to guidance, so I need to put these pieces together. There's a lot of technical thing happening. He's trying to put things. That's the nature of knowledge. So I think on one side, we should now agree.
This is the reality on ground, basically. Dealing with text, and this is what we need to do. I would say that how many lay people do we find that have actually been able to go through the Quran cover to cover enough times that they're able to make these relations? And we said you cannot just pick a verse from the Quran randomly and make huge conclusions out of it. You'll get a certain amount from it, but you can't just go and make conclusions and start building your whole life just because you read the translation of the Quran, you know, once or twice in your life. So practically most people don't even have enough understanding of the Quran as a whole.
Yeah, exactly. So, but again, I would say here that maybe it's a reminder for all of us that, for me first, and then to all of us, that we should increase our connection with the Quran.
Definitely, this is a huge lack.
And these are the months that are coming, especially the month of Ramadan. These are the months of Ibadah, Rajab, Sha'ban, month of Ramadan. It's an amazing opportunity that I can start the Quran and go through it one time. That look what Allah is, because I mean, we have so many narrations that talk about this idea that look, Quran is God speaking to you. It's so important. Like when I'm reading the Quran, I should be in a state where I'm thinking that God is speaking to me. It should be in that state. Okay.
So how is God speaking to me?
Yeah, exactly. So now this becomes a very tricky thing. On one side, we are saying that you need expertise to understand the Quran. There's so many things that are happening. There's chances for misunderstanding. And now that might make us think that, I read Quran just for thawab, for example. I just read this barakat in it. I read the translation, but I can't use it. No, that's not the case. And I would go back to this idea that we need to take a balanced approach. Sometimes we can end up going on extremes. So, but you would say that then how can a layman benefit from the Quran? So I'll try to put it in this manner. And again, we go back to this idea of how we understand texts. So usually what happens is that whenever someone says something or you read a book, there is a certain core meaning that I can safely, conclusively say that this general core meaning was definitely intended by the speaker. In technical terms, it's called qadrul mutayakkan, means a speech can have many, many meanings and a lot of meaning that it holds. But there's that core meaning that I can safely say that this definitely was intended by the speaker. So we can go, let's use the previous examples where we're saying that you need to look at the other verses of the Quran. So the same example. Quran says, Ahallallahu al-bay. Okay. Does it mean that when I read this verse, I don't understand anything? I should just close my mind and say that no, I don't have right to understand it and doesn't make any sense to me? No. There are things that you understand. And that is, so let me tell you that what's that core meaning that you're absolutely certain. You know for sure that certain types of buying and selling transactions are definitely allowed.
At least.
There is a range of a transaction that allow.
And we're saying at least because we're giving the possibility that maybe somewhere else there is a way.
And I might not have the expertise to go and find out, what are all those examples and instances where transactions wouldn't be allowed. I don't have expertise, I don't have time. That's fine. But I can at least get this idea that generally, bay and buying and selling is halal in Islam. Of course, there would be restrictions. Maybe I don't know them, but I understand this core meaning that is there. You can go to other verses. For example, jahidu fi sabilillah. Now I'm confused. Is it for everyone or is it a kifai? The least I know is that some people will have to go. So basically, Whenever there's a text, we are confused between two meanings. He said, it might mean this, it might mean that. Take these two meanings, look at what's the common meaning between them. That definitely is intended.
That's definitely the minimum intended, minimum that I can benefit from. But there's definitely more to it.
There's a lot of precision.
Yeah, because there is more to it which I don't know right now, I can't just go and jump and act on that minimum.
So that's why they say that, for example, we go to the Quran and there are ayatul ahkam, the verses related to ahkam. We read them, right? Question, when I read this verse, akimus salat, I don't understand anything. No, I know that there's something called salat. I don't know what exactly it is. But Allah is saying this has to be established. It's something very important that I need to do. This much I understand. The importance of it, the command related to it, this idea of there's something being salat. I wouldn't know the details right now that how exactly is this salat. Hope I go and refer to next month. I go refer to my marja because it's a matter related to fiqh. I go and ask him that, oh, this salat seems to be very important. And this is what we should do, right? I'm reading the Quran and I come across this idea that wa'atu zakat. I say that there is some kind of a financial obligation I have. See, this is the minimum I understand, right? Now, what exactly is zakat? How much of it is obligatory? What items zakat applies to? I don't have expertise. I don't have time to find out in details. Of course, I have time to go and refer to the risal of my
marja. There's a minimum amount we need to put time exactly. for knowledge.
So this is a way to come to that middle ground, whereby on one side we say that knowing all the details, very accurate meaning, complete meaning, we need experts, definitely need. But each verse, each hadith, I can get that basic minimum meaning and I can benefit a lot. Even that basic meaning is very important.
Yeah, so it's valuable.
It shapes me. For example, Quran comes as innamal hayatu dunya lahwan wa la'ib, saying that the life of this world is a play and a sport. The least I know I can understand is that I need to be careful. There are dangers in this, like drowning into dunya. Okay. But what's that exact meaning of lahw and la'ib? And what's the difference? It's an interesting question, right? Like, why does Quran use two words? So lahw and la'ib. La'ib means play and sport. Lahw means a meaningless activity. So if you want to exactly know, I wouldn't have the expertise to go and refer to Arabic grammar and say, what does lahw mean in the Arabic lexicon? What does la'ib mean in this verse? What does it mean? What does it mean in respect to other verses? See, I won't have the time. But I have the time to open a book of tafsir and go to this verse and see what's the explanation. They'll explain that. Lahw is this, la'ib is this. This is the difference. And why these two are detrimental to my spiritual progress. So that's something we can definitely. So basically, it's a combination of my own basic understanding of the verses of the Quran. And definitely this, that core meaning, Qadrul Mutayakkan, that I can understand. But I need to top it up always with the expert knowledge.
And that's really important. And we need to be careful when we're in doubt. We should also ask, for example, in the same verse in the life of this world is lahw and la'ib. Somebody who does not stick to this qadr al-mutayaqan, that minimum, definite minimum understanding, could be like, okay, this world therefore is useless.
Yeah.
So there's no point being in this world. Like, you know, it's all a play. It's all a, it's not a serious thing, you know, even leading to maybe even suicide, because like, why am I living? Okay. Allah is saying it's useless, right? So going and acting on the meaning of a verse just like that, and let's be practical, our brothers and sisters in one way, yes, we definitely are lacking in our connection with the Quran, and we need to really step up in that big time. And Maha Ramadan is an opportunity to start it, not to then on each day stop it. Yeah, but we also need to be realistic that there's a certain amount we can interact with the Quran. We also have a lot of things in life, like, okay, we decided to be scholars and to spend our life studying it, but that's not practical for everybody. Like right. people have to study other things, medicine and I don't know,
the needs of the
business
society.
And economy and politics and all that. There's needs of society. There's all family to run. So there's a lot of activity, and there's a certain minimum amount that Allah is expecting from all of us to interact with the Quran.
Yeah, so that much pursuit of things we need for a guidance, for a practical life, yeah. we absolutely need.
Yeah,
to
and
pursue.
That
we
connection,
need to make time
that
for it.
That interaction with the Quran and that connection with the Quran can lead us to a lot. It can give us a lot.
Yeah.
But when it comes to details, actions, and like basing our life on these understandings, we need to make sure that these understandings are in line. Keeping in consideration all these elements that are needed to understand properly the Quran.
And this, I'll say it again here, that brothers and sisters, we need to be very careful in attributing things to Quran. So, see, you read a verse of the Quran, there's that core meaning, you understand it and you say that, okay, alhamdulillah, inshallah, I've understood it properly, I'm going to use it. Now, I shouldn't add meanings to that whilst I know that I'm not an expert, and then I'll start attributing it to that. When Allah is talking about this concept in the Quran, He means this, and this is the conclusion. No, we need to be careful, sometimes people, they very easily find instances for the verses of the Quran. Say that this verse is referring to him, this verse is referring to that. No, hold on, take it a bit slowly.
Get inspirations from the Quran, get motivation from the Quran, get that boost from the Quran.
Exactly. And I would even say that one step further would be that we should also start referring to what experts have given us from the Quran. There's so much beauty and so much ma'arif and teachings in the Quran. So just this example I mentioned, it's not to do with ahkam, it's not to do with even akhlaq, it's explaining a reality to me, saying innama al-hayatu dunya lahwun wa laib. It's telling you that look, life of this world is this. Now I understand very briefly certain things, and I should be careful I don't misunderstand and say that, oh, and you should leave this world and everything. No, that's not that. But if I really want, if I go to a good tafsir and understand what this lahw and laib is and what exactly it does to me, believe me, like our lives as believers would be so much more meaningful and enriched. So we need to even take steps to go to the experts and listen to them.
And just like the people at the time of the Prophet would go to the Prophet to ask him, what does Allah really mean by it, and explain and expand on it. We have the Warathatul Anbiya, the ulama who are trying to get the knowledge of the Prophets and the Imams and giving it to us. Okay, so coming back to this whole idea, so what you're suggesting when it comes to discussions like Imama or other Aqidati discussion, so based on the tabi'in, the explanation you've made for us, which makes sense, but then it might come to many people that, okay, that means what you're suggesting is that we should do taqlids in our aqidah. Whereas we have generally grown up with this idea that taqlid is not allowed in aqidah. Can you expand on this? Can you explain this?
Okay, so this whole idea, this question of the idea of taqlid when it comes to the matters of our aqidah and belief, this definitely is an important question. And probably if we want to deal with all its different aspects, we need a lot of time. And it's an important thing. I mean, I wish there would be time and there'd be independent discussions on this. But something that relates to our discussion, because we're going to talk about in this course about Imama, and we're just building the foundations. So very briefly, what you can say here in terms of taqlid in the matters of aqidah is that there are these matters of aqidah which are fundamental in nature. So these are these very important questions related to my belief that I know are going to have a huge and big impact in the way I live. And the way I live has a huge impact in my salvation and where I end up eventually. And we're all concerned about our success and salvation, right? No one wants to end up in a state where he doesn't receive salvation, right? We always pray that the end of our affairs becomes safe and sound, and we reach that salvation. So I had that inner drive that tells me that, look, these are some of the fundamental questions that I need to pursue and find answers to them. Okay. So now I should go after them for sure. These fundamental questions. Does God exist? Do we have guidance? If the Allah sent guidance, which is that guidance? The idea of following the right religion. All of these I need to pursue, and I need to convince myself. I need to understand that this is the right thing. But it may happen that in some cases you might have something very fundamental like imamah, that some aspects of it are tied to, for example, the scriptures, for example, to the transmitted sources, for example, to how Rasulullah appointed, for example,
to a historical event.
So it might happen. And there's no reason to deny that, no, it shouldn't happen. There might be very many reasons that a very fundamental matter becomes tied to some of these factors. So if it's something fundamental and important, so basically, so the idea of imamah is so fundamental. Why? Because you're actually, one of the aspects is you're actually adding a source of your religious knowledge. Mm. So basically, you're saying that after Rasulullah, the source of Islam continues through the line of imams.
That's a big claim. That's different to just talk about political leadership.
It's a political leadership. That's important in its own right, and we'll talk about that. But this is a key question. It's going to define everything I do. If this person who's the imam, and if I accept his imam, and he's going to tell me, you pray like this and you don't pray like this, I have to obey him. It's a big, major change in my life. But it's somehow tied to all these different factors, a part of it to the intellect, a part of it to the scriptures, a part of it to the history. So there, what we would say, and again, when we talk about taqlid, eventually the core of the matter is that, am I doing my responsibility to my creator? So even the idea of taqlid in the ahkam is this thing, right? I'm not an expert in ahkam. I don't have time to become an expert. I can't even not follow Allah's deen and just say that I'll just live a normal life. I don't care about it. So what do? I refer to the best expert. So the idea of having a marja, a'lam, and I rely on his expertise. Why? Because eventually I want to tell Allah that I tried my best.
Okay, but I did aqidah, my responsibility. In aqidah, is this enough though? Can I tell Allah that, look, I didn't have the time to search for the right belief, so I just relied on someone else?
No. So in aqidah, so the difference would come in aqidah is that if the aqidah is a very fundamental part in shaping my life, I would say that no, I have to go and even do research. Even if it means that that research is based on a bit of historical facts, a bit of things to do with our scriptures, a bit of it with the intellect. And that's one of the reasons that we are bringing this this course is being organized, that let's go to it. It's a fundamental matter. Let's understand it, even if it means taking help from experts.
Exactly. So it wouldn't be a taqlid of experts. It would be getting help of experts to get out the facts, hear their arguments, and seeing that if these arguments make sense together, do they form something strong or not. So basically, we would have that ability at a certain level to decipher whether the expert's analysis of this historical event is good enough for me to accept. And therefore, it's a conscious decision to accept an argument, not that I'm just blindly following the expert.
And so in that very, if we say this, then in that very technical sense, we wouldn't say that we are doing taqlid. Because in the matters of ahkam, when we say we are doing taqlid, actually what you're doing is that we are relying on somebody's expertise, and with the condition that I'm not going to look at the proofs he has presented. That's a key thing, because
I'm not going to look at the proofs because it requires expertise which I don't have. But in the discussion we talk about right now, we talk about those aspects that, yes, an expert comes and presents the arguments to me, he brings the facts out, but I do have the ability to decipher if it's correct or not.
So this is very nicely put, that this part, one part of the discussion is has to come from the experts. So I want to understand imamah. I can't go to a non-expert and ask him that explain it to me. or tell it to me. Why? Because I'm not even sure if it's...
Tell me, al-yawm akmaltu lakum dinakum, al-yawm, what's al-yawm? Yeah. I don't know.
So the right approach would be, you go to an expert who's understood the Quran well, with all that procedure and expertise he has, you ask him for the explanation, and then now I'll sit and I'll understand and analyze it. Okay, this al-yawm, there are so many historical records of that it was this day. It's mentioned in so many different places. And then... And now I can say that, okay, so therefore al-yawm, for example, was the day of Ghadir. And what happened on the day of Ghadir that it became the Ikmaluddin? And I'll put all these pieces together. The least that's expected, and this is important, is that the main and those general important parts of imama, I should establish myself.
Yeah.
That what is the disposition of imam? Who are the individual imams? Because their individuals are important, right? Because this individual I'm supposed to obey, for example, or his source of my religion. So that I need to establish. But let us say there's a very, very specific matter of imama, very theoretical, doesn't have any practical implications. So for example, just this idea that the imams in their day-to-day lives, would they commit an action? So forget about sins. So sins would say that they're infallible. Would they do something which would be an inadvertent mistake? Like by mistake, I put my hand and this glass fell.
Would imam do that or not?
Yeah, would imam do that or not?
Doesn't matter.
So we would definitely say that he won't commit a sin. We'll have an explanation and the thing for it, and intellectual and both. But this idea that without intending, would he make like a regular mistake? Like this, I mean, by mistake, I put my hand and this glass fell.
Yeah.
Would I be held responsible if I don't answer this question?
Would say, no, it's not a big
deal. You wouldn't be, because you've gone into a very, very specific... Yeah, there might be answers. There might be narrations that speak about it.
Yeah.
But so that... core matters of imama would have to be not taqlid in that sense, that because just someone said it.
And that's, I guess that's probably why when Shia scholars discuss imama and at least the fundamental aspects of imama, they usually bring the different scholars' arguments, says, look, these are what they're saying, this is what we're saying, you be the judge.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Does that make sense or does this make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
The facts, everybody's brought the same facts, so we're all clear on the facts, for example, Ghadir happened and so on. You be the judge, basically. When you say you be the judge, it's not taqlid anymore.
Yeah, it's right? Trying to
it's lead using you the expert's information to then make an educated conclusion.
They would never write the issue of imam in their risala and say, yeah, that I've done my research, I've concluded that these are the 12 imams, these are the names, and that's it, you need to believe because I'm an expert. No. Yeah. In the particular matters of fiqh, this is what we would do.
Yeah.
For the reasons that are there in its own place discussed in, yeah, the discussion Ishad and Taqlid. But the good way to summarize it would be this. So in one way, if you really insist, you can call it, for example, Taqlid, because you're benefiting from the expert. But from another angle, it's not that Taqlid that we do in fiqh, whereby we don't ask for the reason and the argument and explanation. And that was a very good point I think you made, that... the Shia scholars always have approached the issue of imama in a fashion where they're presenting the argument, where they're trying to convince, they're trying to make it tangible and understandable. For even the Shias, when they would speak, they would teach them that, look, the imams are there because of this reason, this reason, this reason. And even when they would discuss with those people who did not accept imama, it was always a presentation of proof by an expert. So that I think is an important point that you made.
Okay, so I think the time is over.
Okay, I think in terms of the Holy Quran and how it's understood, I think we tried our best to speak about so many different matters.
So now we're going to actually apply some of these things when we're analyzing the imama from the Quran. We need to keep some of these things in mind. So, for example, the fact that just by taking one or two verses, we can't just come to conclusions.
Exactly.
We need to look at the context, and you know, we're going to apply all of this, inshallah, in that session with Sheikh Ali, inshallah, discussing this. Yeah.
So there's only one discussion that remains that will continue, and that's also an important discussion, is that as an extension from the Quran, we have this idea of hadith And the person of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam also being the source of religion. And if the imama is established, then that idea of hadith even extends to the 12 imams. Okay, for now we won't, I'm not going to emphasize and focus on the hadith from the 12 imams, but, and that will come later. If you establish their imama and establish that as imams they are also sources of religion, then the same discussion can that relates to Rasulullah, that his words being also a source of religion would apply to them as well. So this is a discussion that we need to have, that we can't say hasbuna kitabullah. I don't know, I put it like this, that Quran leads us to another source, and it's a rather important source. And how do we approach it? And there are some issues with that should be discussed regarding hadith as a source of religion. So maybe we will have
we'll discuss that in more details. Thank you so much, Sheikhna.
Thank you very much.
It was a very interesting discussion. Brothers and sisters, inshallah, the discussion was beneficial. We hope to continue one more session to lay the foundations, and obviously the foundations of hadith and ilm al-rijal is an important foundation for the discussion of imamah specifically. So we'll do that in the next session, and then after that, I'll promise you, we'll jump into imamah and start discussing imamah itself. But bear with one more session of these foundations, really important. I hope you appreciate the importance of this. You'll appreciate it even more when we actually start digging into imamah itself. Okay, so inshallah, we'll come back in the next session. So until then, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.